Welcome to Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay. My guest is Elizabeth Nunez. We'll be talking about her latest novel, Now Lila Knows. Just imagine this. You're a professor from the Caribbean going to America to do a year teaching at a university in Vermont. And your very first day there, coming from the airport, you see somebody murdered. And that's really how the novel starts. And it's such a shocking beginning, Elizabeth, to the novel. I mean, it really captures your attention because in my mind, you have this almost this innocent type of personality coming to America and the shock of seeing a man murdered by the police on the street in front of her. What a way to start the novel.
Well, yes. But as you know, thank you so much, Hopeton. This is, I think, the second or third time you have interviewed me for your show. And I am so grateful, so appreciative. This is just a wonderful opportunity for me to talk about my work and to talk about Black writers in general. So thank you so much. Yes, it is a beginning for the novel, but it's not just any man she saw being shot. And it's not anybody she saw shooting him. It happened to be a Black man who was shot. And he was shot by the police. And he was shot because he was giving, and I don't think I'm giving away the novel by saying this because you read this within the first chapter. He is giving CPR to a white woman. And so therefore he has his mouth on the white woman's mouth. And the police come up to him and they ask him to get away, move away. But of course, he is blowing life into this woman's body and he doesn't stop. And because he doesn't stop, they shoot him and they kill him. So there are two things I'm looking at, Hopeton, in this novel. One, it's the prevalence of this kind of murder, let's call it what it is, or a better term, I suppose, is police brutality of Black men. So there's that I'm looking at. But as you said, this is a Caribbean woman coming to teach at the university in Vermont, and this is the first thing she sees. So the fact that she is not of the country, but she is a Black woman, the question is a question that Martin Luther King asked us to look at, which is where he says that the only way for danger to propagate is for good people to do nothing. So the question is, does this woman, who is Lila, does she tell what she sees? Well, the place she's going to, the college she's going to in Vermont, is primarily white. The students are almost 100% white. And there are three Black faculty. One of them is the one she saw shot. So the other two Black faculty have that expectation that as a Black woman from the Caribbean, this woman would join forces with her and tell what she sees.
And let me jump in here real quick because the character of Terrence, and one of the things I found interesting, Terrence is the Black professor who's really pushing her tell what she saw. Yeah. But let's also talk about her fiancé back home island, Robert. Mm-hmm. And Robert is going the opposite way. Robert does not want her to get involved at all. So we have this conflict between her on the phone with her fiancé, constantly saying, don't get involved. This is America. Keep to yourself. And then you have Terrence constantly saying, you need to do your duty.
Yeah. And of course, the commonality there for Terrence is the Black professor is that this is a Black woman. She should realize what the situation is. And that's why the novel is called Now Lila Knows.
Yeah, but let's talk about her being a Black woman, because there's a point in the novel. There are so many layers to this novel. You've taken on really sensitive subjects, which is the way that people of African descent in other countries don't necessarily embrace being Black.
That's exactly right.
And this is something that Lila comes from a conservative family. French planters who were slaveholders. And we're seeing the development of Lila as this novel goes. We're seeing her struggle with her changing identity. I mean, she knows who she is, but really trying to go to a next level. And we're also seeing her throughout the novel realize that she may not no longer agree with the position that her grandmother takes, who raised her, when it comes to these issues that her fiance takes. And her fiance actually says, "You're not black, you're colored." Wow.
Now that, now that's the tragedy. That is what I wanted to deal with in this novel. And Hopeton, I'm holding my breath right now. Novel is being read by people who are not Americans, black people, people of color, people of African descent. I'm not sure how they will feel, how they will react to it. But I think I'm telling the truth. And the truth is that people of color in the Caribbean and elsewhere would hold on to their lineage in different ethnic groups. But their lineage, which is what is the marker on their bodies, the color of their skin, which connects them to Africa, they don't necessarily want to embrace. So Robert, her fiance, prefers the term colored. You know, he says, "Don't talk about yourself as being black, Lila. You're colored." Well, what does that mean? Lila is not all that innocent, because remember, she sings that nursery rhyme. There's a brown girl in a ring, tra-la-la-la girl, there's a brown girl. And she says, "Well, maybe I'm brown." You know?
Right.
But of course, the notion of blackness has much more to do with color, as we all know. Through Robert, I am presenting a point of view of people of color who have African blood, but do not embrace it and do not embrace their connection because of their African blood to African Americans. And that's what I'm trying to deal with. So Robert tells her, "Hey, Lila, stay away from this. This is not your business. This is African American business. You don't have to report what you see." Terrence doesn't tell her right away this is what she should do. He has that expectation. He's waiting for her. He's waiting for her to acknowledge that she is part of this. She has every reason to give an excuse. And Hopeton, I'm also not only, as you said, there are many layers to this novel. I'm not also talking about African Americans. I'm also talking about people of color who are not from America. I'm also talking about immigrants, you know. I mean, immigrants come to this country, and I'm talking about immigrants of color. And factually, historically, absolutely true, they owe their presence here to African Americans, straight off. That is why they, and you know why, Hopeton. 1964, the Civil Rights Bill was signed. 1965, the Immigration Act was signed. What was the new Immigration Act? It was removing country of origin as a criteria for immigrating. What does that mean? Before 1965, country of origin was a criteria for coming for immigration. And where was that country? Northern Europe. You may go to Southern Europe, you may go to Eastern Europe, but you're sure as heck not going to Africa or India or China or Korea or the Middle East or the Caribbean. So when you have 64, the civil rights bills being signed, African Americans fighting for equality, fighting for their rights, their civil rights. And then the next year comes, removing country of origin, the floodgates open. The floodgates open. And that's where you have immigrants of color. That's where you have people from Africa, people from the Caribbean, people from Korea, people from India, people from China. All these people owe a debt to African Americans. That's where I stand. So this is what Lila is going to learn, that she cannot be a disinterested person. She cannot say, this doesn't concern me. Yeah, that's why you're here. That's how you got your position. That's why the door opened for you. You can't say this is African-American business. This is their racial problem. African-Americans have fought for that, had fought that fight on racism. And the door opened. In many ways, as you know, opened the door open. But I am narrowing it to say the door opened for immigrants. So
this novel to me, you, as I was reading this novel, I felt like you were making a powerful statement. I felt like you were, like there was a strong message that you really want to send. And the way you not only look at the race issue, you look at colorism, you right. also look at class. Specifically, let's talk about her previous boyfriend, Kenton.
Right.
And how she was in love with him. And he basically says, you're Bernard Bonnard, mm-hmm. I'm a cudgel.
Yeah.
Who was the Maroon leader in Jamaica.
Right.
And there was just this this recognition. And I have some friends from a place called King River, Louisiana.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Who are descendants of French and Spanish slave owners. Mm-hmm. And this issue of class, the way you talk about the way the elite in St. Marie, which is a fictional island, which apparently comes from a BBC show, I believe.
No, I made it up.
Well, there was actually, there's literally an island, St. Marie, that's news for the name of an island in the Caribbean on a BBC well. Show. Wow. All right. But I thought addressing this, the way that the elite looked down on the Baptists, especially the Baptist shouters.
Oh, yes, 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 yes. Well, that's always, again, her first boyfriend, as you said, that she really was in love with. Her family have a problem with her, with that boyfriend, mostly because he's too dark skinned. He's too dark skinned. So they talk a lot of hubler loop, you know, better to be with your own kind. People, they say the people with light skin have an easier time in this world. You don't need to go have babies with this man. You're going to have dark skinned children. They have a harder time. They have every reason, but it's his color. He also figures her out. Her fiance, the one she's in love with, also figures her out. Because he says, you know, I want to go to Africa. And it was interesting to me that when he says to her where he wants to go, she doesn't even know the place.
She thinks it's part of Nigeria.
She thinks it's part of Nigeria. She thinks Niger is part of Nigeria. She doesn't even know. She doesn't even know the map. She doesn't even know her background. I'm sure she knows everything about Europe, but she doesn't know. So, So that was class and color, you know, class, color, and religion, all being intertwined.
Now, I love some of the literary references you have in here. Mm-hmm. I always get excited when someone references books that I actually read. okay. Black Skin, White Mask by Frantz Fanon, mm-hmm. Which I read many, many years ago. And this is a book, I believe, being recommended by Terrence for one of his students to read.
Right.
Right.
Go ahead.
And so, yeah, this was a powerful book, and I'm going to sort of paraphrase it, where Black Skin, White Mask, the blacks in formerly colonized country adopting the standards of behavior and class, et cetera, from their white colonizers.
So, mm-hmm. So this is indirectly how they get to Lila. Indirectly, because she gets this note that accuses her of against what Fanon is saying, calls her a puppet of the colonists. And this would be what Fanon would call Black Skin, White Mask, you know? So it was kind of a joy, because as you know, I read that book too, was in love with all of Fanon's work. And it's also what I tried to do, Hopeton. I tried to as much as it would be organic to put these major classics into my work. And hopefully they would catch the eye of the reader, and the reader who may not have read Frantz Fanon would say, oh my God, maybe I should go read it. And then as you recall, early in the novel, she's reading Derek Walcott's Omeros. So this is a major work of this Caribbean writer who takes on Homer's Iliad, you know?
Doesn't steal it. One of her students says, yes, he stole it, the idea. She's like, wait. No.
But Homer did, and you could accuse Homer from stealing it because it wasn't original to Homer either. He just heard all these stories and wrote them down. So I also cite Merle Hodges' Crick Crack Monkey. So I am very conscious in my writing to integrate works of not only Caribbean, African, European writers, the classics that I think are important, and hopefully they're organic to the novel, and hopefully they will stick out in the reader's mind and say, maybe I should go read this novel.
And there was another book
that
was organic to the novel. So there's a point in the novel where her ex-boyfriend, Kenton, who's gone to Africa, doesn't believe that a degree in literature could change the world or make it better. Mm-hmm. But you write in the book, but he was wrong. There was power in fiction, and the catharsis story made possible. Catharsis had opened her heart to feelings, and feelings had led to a desire to act. And I'm thinking specifically about A Different Drummer by William Melvin Kelly. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I just came across that book and fell in love with that novel, and more or less fell in love with him and his life, and got scared for the position of Black writers, for which I am so grateful to you, Hopeton, because this man, William Melvin Kelly, was celebrated. He was celebrated. And then when the powers to be, the publishers, the people who love that kind, were bored with it and were looking at another topic, another interest, they no longer published his books. And he kept on writing, but in his 70s, he was seen in dumpsters looking for food.
Oh, no.
So it's a cautionary tale. I mean, his novel itself, I would want people to read, but it's a cautionary tale for what happens to Black writers. I mean, there's one thing to be a writer. When you ask me what I've been doing all these between that novel that you interviewed me with and now, I'm writing. So there is the writing, but there is the publishing, and the publishing can stop the writer. The publishing can stop the writer if the writer doesn't have another job. And I do. I'm a professor, so I have income for my housing and my food. But that is not fair. Most writers get their income from the writers that we celebrate, they had patrons, let's say, or they would get a good advance in their books, right? Which allows them the time to write. I don't have 100% time to write. I'm teaching, right? So, you know, people like you are so central. I happen to have read Viola Davis's biography. Are we off?
No, we're still on.
Something came up. Are you seeing me? I'm not seeing
you. I'm seeing you.
Oh, I don't know why. Let me click that off and see what happens, because I'm not seeing me. I'm going to believe you're seeing me.
Just keep going.
Okay. Viola Davis's biography. She, at some point in that bio, she says, you know, there is the talent and there are seats to fill the seats. What she's saying is the reason people weren't giving me attention was because I wasn't filling seats. And it's the same thing for the writer. There is the talent. There are talented Black writers. The reason we are not reading their books, or their books aren't in the bookshelves, is that they aren't readers. And so what happens? We have to depend on people like you. We have to depend on people like you who would talk about the book and hopefully encourage people to buy the book, because people think it's because I want to get money from my books. That's not it.
You're not making that much money from selling these books.
I'm not.
And I know the industry that much.
Yeah, and I'm saved not only by people like you, but by people like Akashic Books. Akashic Books certainly isn't making the millions of dollars that a publisher would make, but they would see the talent and they would publish the book. They would take a chance on you. So that's that book, The Different Drummer. The story about what that different drummer is about is what influenced Lila, but the story about the author is what affects me. You know, say, look at how they can just shut that man's mouth. They just shut him down. And that's a publishing decision.
So the other play that's central throughout your novel is The Tempest, and specifically the character of Caliban. Mm-hmm. So, and let's see, I believe at some point in the novel, you talk about the character did a work which was critical of the Western interpretation of the character of Caliban in the play, The Tempest. And, you know, knowing that the play, you see the imperialism and the way, you know, the colonial mindset with the way the play was written, which is Caliban's there first, but they come on the island, they have a wreck, they take it over, they refer to him as a savage. But at one point, Shakespeare gave Caliban the most beautiful, the most lyrical lines in the play. Be not afeared. Talk about that.
So that's the conundrum that people have about it. I mean, if you read that play and you take Prospero's point of view, then you will say that Caliban belongs to a vile race. Of course, people of color, of African descent, say that vile race is talking about me. And Prospero says things like, stripes may move him, not kindness. Nobody to be kind to him, just beat him. Stripes may move, not kind. But all of a sudden, in that play, the most beautiful lines in that play are said by Caliban, the person of vile race. And what struck me, Hopeton, which I put into the novel, is I happened to be sitting in my living room at the 2012 Summer Olympics in London. And what did I see? Up on a hill, I guess at Nottingham Hill, I don't know what hill that was in England, were these Englishmen in black frock coats and tall hats. And what were they saying? Be not afeard. This isle is full of noises that give delight and fear not. And I'm saying, what isle are they talking about? Are they talking about the Isle of Britain? Talk about appropriation. That was appropriation. So I play with that. So what I did in that novel is I took on all, you know, the Western European world said, all these Caribbean people, these Latinos, these people who are just saying that Caliban, they identify with Caliban. Why should they identify with Caliban? So I said, I'm not saying to be Caliban. I'm just asking you to look at that play and see who has the most beautiful lines. And Hopeton, what you do know or should know is that Shakespeare gives his most beautiful lines, most lyrical lines to the characters he most admires. He's actually almost in blank verse to the characters he does not admire. So if you look at a play like Hamlet, the most lyrical lines are said by Hamlet. When you come on the two people who were Hamlet's buddies, but who ended up being spies to try to have him killed, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, they're actually speaking in blank verse, almost in prose. So you don't have to look any further. You could just analyze Shakespeare's plays in terms of the meter and the beat and the lyricism of the lines to figure out where is Shakespeare going. So now you have to answer this question. Why did he give Caliban the most beautiful lines? So beautiful that those English people opened the 2012 Olympics with those lines. I'm just throwing it out.
Well, Oscar-winning director Danny Boyle said that William Shakespeare's play The Tempest served as an inspiration for his the opening ceremony of the 2012 London Olympics. And I did remember, as these things came up, that you wrote a book called Prospero's Daughter.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I did.
Let's see. Caliban's, I'm reading directly from the review in New York Times. Caliban's enraged response to Prospero's accusation that he attempted to rape his daughter, Nunez, who is a master at pacing and plotting, explores the motivations behind Caliban's outburst, hatching an entirely new story that is inspired by Shakespeare, but not beholden to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I thought, well, let's flip the script a little bit.
Sure.
Here. Let's look at that play from a different point of view, because point of view is how you analyze work. So all along, the point of view of critical analysis is through Prospero. But if you are somebody like me, where the European has come to my island and taken it over, in other words, colonized it, told us how to speak, how to eat, what books to read, what is the nature of our education? In other words, all through secondary school, the only books I read were about European literature, English literature to be correct. So if you want to take that point of view and say, oh, Prospero was pretty nice to the natives, the Europeans were, go ahead. But let's flip it around and take the point of view of somebody like me, someone who had I lived in a colony when I was in high school. Trinidad was a colony. So you take that point of view. In other words, let's take Caliban's point of view and look at the story from that. Don't change anything in the play. Just take it from his point of view. And that's what I did in Prospero's Daughter. I'm very pleased about that because a lot of people are doing dissertations and writing articles based on it. As a matter of fact, 3 years ago, I was invited to the University of Siena in Italy, and they were doing a doctoral dissertation on that novel. So there we go.
Well, what I want to close with is something that Lila says. They're trying to get her to come back.
Oh, yeah.
And she gets the game now.
Mm-hmm.
So she says, I know the game they're playing. And she says, I suspect white America is more comfortable with us, mm-hmm. foreign blacks. With you, African-Americans, they have a constant reminder of America's original sin. So she tells Terrence, who's excited about her being offered another year, they need to hire an African-American.
Mm-hmm. Hopton, I believe that absolutely. And African-Americans are extremely generous, but African-Americans also need to wake up to the game. So yes, I share the same skin color. And yes, I share the same history, namely people from Africa were brought across that middle passage to work on the plantation. But there is a particular situation in America, and you cannot get away from that. And all Americans knew it. So the average white American that you would see maybe can go back 2 or 3 generations to Italy or to Europe or to wherever they came from. African Americans can go back, as we know, to 1619. They can go back to ownership of this country. I mean, that this is my home. This is my home. So, I mean, the Native Americans are the ones all the way. So. I think Nyla is speaking the truth. She is saying that, and I don't want to cause a problem, Hopton, but look at the leaders we choose all the time. We choose leaders and we get so happy that they are Black, but they have one darn thing in common. They have no connection to America's original sin. Think about that. We get totally excited, and it's the generosity of African Americans. It's the generosity of African Americans. It's not enough. It's not enough. I have lived long enough to see the game. So I pose, I am a twofer. I'm Black, I'm a woman, but I pose no great threat to white America. I do not have a connection to America's original sin. I can, in fact, I don't have to bleed your conscience. When you see me, you're not seeing somebody saying you owe me something in reparation. But my son, whose father is African-American, when they see him, yep, you owe him. You owe him and his father and his father's mother.
Wow.
That's what I was trying to write about.
Elizabeth Nunez, author of Now Lila Knows, published by Akashic Books, comes out, or by the time you listen to this, came out June the 7th, 2022. This book is so revealing. You have lyrical language there. You address some very sensitive issues that deal with African people of African descent from other countries, especially the Caribbean. You deal with Black matters, Black Lives Matter, reparations. I mean, it is just such a wonderful kaleidoscope of the African-American and African-Caribbean experience. So thank you so much for being a guest on Diverse Voices Book Review.
Thank you so much, Hoopton. Thank you so much for giving me this chance for my voice. I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to this podcast edition of Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hoopton Hay, host and producer. The theme music is provided by Wright Productions. You can follow the show on social media. Under Facebook and Instagram, it's Diverse Voices Book Review, or Twitter under @DiverseBooksHay.